you hear stuff anyway, and kind of that impression, oh yeah, I'm gonna sort of crash or, you know, blow up or whatever.
No one said that, did they?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe some Scottish journalists that don't have a clue, I guess. But I listened to it, you know.
No.
It was kind of, it was funny because after the tour, obviously it went really well for me. So I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to a few podcasts, see what people were saying. And what was that word? Fanciful.
Yeah.
Appreciate that, yeah. And also I'm sure people have said like, oh, but maybe he's a one-hit wonder or something. So that's that. Have you said that?
Not yet.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freiba.
Hello.
Daniel.
In person.
In person, and wearing a nice little cycling casquette at a jaunty angle.
Zacobeo Galicia. When were they around?
Any meaning?
They disbanded in about 2010, I think.
I think it's about 2010 because it says so on the hat.
Oh, does it? Of course,
was that the team of Ezequiel Mosquera, who finished second in the Vuelta and then
was subsequently disqualified?
Yeah.
And who finished second as a result of his disqualification? I'm not sure. I think Peter Vaelitz, possibly.
Great start to the podcast.
He maybe moved up to third. I always wear a casquette to podcast. You know, you don't see me usually when I'm podcasting nowadays, but I always wear
a... That's your podcasting hat. Is it a good luck charm, or...?
I wouldn't say that.
Well, we'll soon find out. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Vinoteca in King's Cross in London.
We are. We are gathered here today because we've all been in London for our now annual show. We were at the Clapham Grand a couple of nights ago, and... It was a wonderful night. We had friends and colleagues there, Francois Tomaso, Seb Piquet, Ciro Scogna, Emilio Fran Reyes. They all joined us, and we're going to hear from some of them later on in the episode, just catch up with them in the off-season. We also had Larry Warbass and Connor Dunn join us as our special guests. Now, Larry is, of course, joining AG2R next year. Connor, we believe, has... or is about to sign for a team. He cannot reveal the name of the team yet, but he has found a team, so he will be in employment and racing again next year.
Stop press. I was worryingly accurate, uncharacteristically accurate. 2010, Ezequiel Mosquera did finish second in the Vuelta, was disqualified, and then reinstated. Peter Vaelitz was third, so for a short time he was second, but then demoted again to third.
Sorry, I misheard you. I thought you said Peter Veening.
Oh.
So I scrunched my face up.
Well, to say. It's really good to clear that up. Did you enjoy the other night, chaps? I mean, Larry Warbass, Connor Dunn were fantastic guests, very popular with the crowd, and spent a lot of time afterwards talking to a lot of the people who'd come, which was great to see. Larry peeled himself away from an intensive French course that he's doing in Nice to be au fait with the French ahead of joining AG2R. I think he's the first American rider ever to ride for AG2R, isn't he?
Yes.
They've had Australians before, but never, I don't believe...
Not many American riders have ridden for French teams in the last decade.
Bobby
Julin?
Bobby Julin?
In the last decade?
Well, is that because the Americans... Well, the American president branded the entire nation a bunch of cheese-eating surrender monkeys, didn't he? So, I mean... American French.
Is that why no American riders have ridden for French teams?
I think it's
Lionel.
Directly that those two things are absolutely linked. Well, it might also have something to do with, you know, Lance Armstrong and brand USA being slightly damaged in French cycling. Maybe.
And any French riders on American teams? Pierre Roland.
Oh yeah.
But Larry Warbass doing his bit then for French American relations. Today's podcast, as I mentioned, we're going to hear from some of our regular guests later on in the episode. Orla Chenoui as well. Sorry, I forgot Orla, but we've got a chat with Orla as well because she did a long interview with Geraint Thomas last week. I also did an interview with Geraint Thomas, which you will hear in this episode. And we'll get on to that. But first, Lionel, any news? Anything happening in the world of cycling?
Well, it's been a quiet week, although that may be because we've been very busy with... you know, we were preoccupied with planning for our show. I didn't really answer your question about whether I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it tremendously. The atmosphere was fantastic. We had a full house.
At Maratera.
The the Clapham Grand. Amalaterra played their set, including the famous Giro d'Italia music that we used, the song Cozze. And it was a lovely night, wasn't it? Christmas starts here. But in the world of cycling, well, just a few things have caught my attention this week. Firstly, well, we've got to keep tabs on the Aqua Blue Sport Team story because that is rumbling on. Cycling News have received an email from the CEO of the team, Tom Timmerman, who had emailed all of the riders, and a copy of this email was sent to the website cyclingnews.com, and it basically details the payments that are due to the riders and makes the point that the money is with the UCI and the money will be paid to the riders in accordance with the UCI distributing that money, which is basically placed on account in case a team goes bust. But also in that story was the revelation that Aqua Blue Sport, which technically doesn't really exist anymore, the team doesn't exist, the website doesn't exist, but presumably there's an entity, a company that exists, and the suggestion is that legal action is going to be taken against one unnamed rider. And Tom Timmerman, the CEO, also making the point that they are unhappy that riders have put their side of the story out there in the media. Now, at the risk of editorialising slightly, I think that Aqua Blue can't, that they don't really have a leg to stand on in that case, not least because Rick Delaney, the boss and owner of the team, well, he gave his side of the story to us here on the Cycling Podcast during the Vuelta a España. Richard, you spoke to him at length and he explained how the team had reached its end and come to a halt. So we can't really say, well, I can have my say in the media or we can have our say in the media, but sorry, the riders are not entitled to do so, particularly now that the team doesn't exist.
I suppose, Lionel, the only caveat to that might be that I imagine in the riders' contracts with the team there is a clause to the effect that riders mustn't do anything to damage the image of the team. Those clauses presumably are still valid. And there probably isn't the reverse kind of clause. It's unlikely that there's anything that says that the team can't say anything that would damage the reputation of the rider.
I imagine that's probably the case, but when this is playing out in the court of public opinion, it's not a great look, is it?
No,
it's not a great look to say, look, riders, you all shut up. We stopped the team mid-season, put up and shut up. Particularly when Rick Delaney was on our podcast, I mean, go back and listen to that. It was in the towards the end of the first week that we spoke to Rick Delaney, or Richard, you spoke to Rick Delaney at length, and he made all sorts of statements in that about how he would do the right thing, he would look after the riders, he would honour the contracts, and I don't think it's unreasonable to hold Aqua Blue Sport to those statements. And the riders will have heard what Delaney said in public and on the record, and I think they have a right to hold him to his words. And yeah, certainly looks messy now, a lot messier than it needed to be, and particularly when you look at the fact that the money does appear to be there, the UCI are the custodians of that money at the moment, it does make you wonder why take such a calamitous route when it comes to the PR and the way that the team and the individuals are being discussed in public, when they could perhaps have gone on to the end of the season and, you know, wound down a bit more gracefully, perhaps. They've taken a different course, and each turn that comes out in the public domain, well, it doesn't really reflect terribly well on the way they chose to bring the team to a halt. But this will no doubt rumble on. But like you say, Rich, Conor Dunn, Larry Warbass, Adam Blythe, Eddie Dunbar, and a few others have got contracts with other teams. Notably, I guess, Andy Fenn and a few others haven't. So we shall watch that with interest.
A little stop press here, because after we had recorded this week's episode and while it was being edited together, the news broke that Conor Dunn has agreed a deal to ride for the Israel Cycling Academy team. And this is a story we will no doubt pick up again in a future week.
A story that caught my eye in the Sunday Telegraph is that Dr. Richard Freeman, former British Cycling and Team Sky doctor, of course, has been told to expect a General Medical Council tribunal will look into the delivery of the testosterone patches to British Cycling HQ in 2011. That's a pretty serious development for Dr. Freeman and his status as a qualified doctor. And lastly, the Andrea Taffy circus looks like it's going to roll into town. He may well get his ride in Paris-Roubaix at the age of 52 next April. Rumours on the internet, Daniel, that he has agreed a deal or is in the process of agreeing a deal
with Dimension Data.
With a surprising team, yeah. Dimension Data. That, I mean, I'm my flabber is ghasted about that, really.
I'm surprised it's a World Tour team that's contemplating taking him on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the nature of the deal that's been proposed, whether it's just to ride Paris-Roubaix, whether it's to ride races before Paris-Roubaix, whether it's to end at Paris-Roubaix.
Who on that team would fancy Paris-Roubaix? Edvald Boasenhagen, maybe? Anybody else?
Well, they've reinforced their classics department, haven't they, with Valgren, but he's not really a Paris-Roubaix kind of rider. Vermont, who signed for the team last year, is someone who could go well in Paris-Roubaix. So they got a reasonable team for Paris-Roubaix, and don't forget also that all teams now can only field 7 riders in those World Tour one-day races. So that's another spot that would go to Taffy. I mean, I can well imagine that someone like Andrea Taffy, even at the age of 50, could probably still do a reasonable job in a team role. Certainly at a certain point in the race, maybe in the first 150 kilometres. However, I don't think that is what is on his mind. I think he would like to be as competitive as possible.
And on, forgive me for asking this, time, but on what evidence do you base that? Because
he rode a race last year, I think in Hungary. I forget the name of the race and the exact category of the race, but he was running against pro riders and he finished it in the peloton. And he's a fit guy and fit ex-riders in their 50s on occasion, they still can put in performances that aren't that far away from what's happening in the World Tour on certain terrain. And in a flat race like Paris-Roubaix, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that he could be relatively competitive.
But no one else is looking at the result of that Hungarian race and picking out a potential Paris-Roubaix top 10 rider from the people who finished in the bunch that day, are they? I mean, this is nonsense.
No, but they're not doing... I mean, whichever team signs Andrea Taffy, if a team does sign him, I don't think anyone's going to make any bones about the fact that it's a publicity stunt.
Here we are. Here we are feeding that publicity machine.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I don't want to be ageist about it. And Andrea Taffy always had the look of an alpha male, didn't he? So, I mean, you don't lose that characteristic. I mean, they all are, I guess. You can't survive in the World Tour peloton without being a competitive beast. That fire doesn't suddenly extinguish after retirement. I kind of get that 50 is the new 40, apparently. Is that right? I mean, you're smirking,
apparently,
Richard.
Apparently,
I'll find out in a few years. I mean, 40 feels like the new 60 at the moment for me, I've got to say. But if you were a Dimension Data rider, if this rumour is true, or any World Tour team, it doesn't reflect that well on you if they're bringing in Andrea Taffy. It's a bit like Wayne Rooney coming back for his England friendly this week, and the current England players must be thinking, well, hang on a minute, this guy is retired from international
football.
There
are one or two teams whose riders would probably be very grateful for someone to take one of those spots in Paris-Roubaix. Movistar, for example.
Yeah, they sometimes only line up with a man short, don't they?
Andrea Taffy's fellow Tuscan and good friend, I think, Max Chiandri, has just joined Movistar as a director sportif. So who knows? That could be a possibility.
Wow, this is speculation upon speculation.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa, for their support. Still waiting for my Explorer jacket. I think, Lionel, you're on the lookout for a nice new jacket as well, aren't you?
Well, if you get your Explorer jacket, I've got my eye on the new commuter jacket, to be honest. It's cut more generously for commuting, but that would be ideal for my everyday regular cycling, a little more generous cut. It's highly visible, comes in, 3 very visible colours, orange, high-vis pink, and a yellow that they're calling chartreuse, and also black, which is visible against very light backgrounds. and it's basically meant to be visible but also breathable, so you can ride to work wearing it maybe with some regular clothes underneath, or you know, you're not gonna turn up to work you know, soaking wet and in need of you know, a complete sponge down before your day's work begins. And they are available now on rafa.cc.
I will also mention that Rafa are involved in the London Bicycle Film Festival, which starts on Friday the 23rd of November, and they're showing their preview screening of the latest Outskirts film. Outskirts film is a kind of extension of the Thereabouts films, which involve the Morton brothers, Lachlan, who's now signed for Education First, and Gus Morton. This latest film, Outskirts, is about four riders cycling the length of the Trans-Labrador Highway, one of the longest gravel roads in the world in the remotest corner of northeastern Canada, from Labrador to Newfoundland. It stars Gus Morton, Dan Craven, the Namibian ex-pro. I think he's an ex-pro now. He's been around for quite a long time, Dan Craven. Sami Sauri and Jacob Rathi. That's being shown at 7 p.m. at the Courthouse Hotel in Shoreditch. That's in East London. Tickets are free but limited, and you can sign up at the festival website or at rafa.cc. They're really good. I know they're actually working on another film now, the Morton brothers. So they're really interesting, and they tap into, I guess, some of the things that Education First are going to be doing with their alternative calendar next year, and of course your very soon to be released Explore series, Lionel.
Yep, Explore kicks off on Friday, November the 16th. Episode one is on the Transcontinental Race. Features the winner for the past 2 years, James Hayden, a few other people, and also catching up with the group of women who've been riding the Tour de France route a day ahead of the men's Tour de France race. Really interesting interviews with a couple of people who've been part of that, and that's all out in episode one of Explore at the end of the week.
While we're talking about bicycling for fun, exploration and that kind of thing, I want to mention Bex Waters, who goes under the name Bikepacking Bex on Instagram. She's cycling from London to Kathmandu in 100 days, raising money for Street Child UK, which is a very good charity. She tagged us in an Instagram post. During her ride, she was crossing from Georgia into Azerbaijan when she posted this. But she writes, I promised myself that I would follow one Grand Tour this year, as I've never really got the hype about watching pro racing. So I thought I should give it a chance. I'm currently belatedly following the Vuelta via the cycling podcast, which is actually super interesting. Yates has just taken the red jersey. Is it too late to put money on him winning? I'll not give you any spoiler alerts, Bex. And in fact, you're probably not listening to this because you're still on the Vuelta. But it's nice to hear that as you ride, take on that great challenge, you are listening to our Vuelta coverage. That's nice, and an interesting way of
that
doing
things. That must make the days in the saddle absolutely fly by, eh?
you were mentioning Explore Series. We've also got an episode of the Cycle Podcast Feminar going out this week. Lots of interviews in that. Audrey Cordon, Rago. We've got an interview with Madeline Pape, who's a former runner but an expert now on some of the issues around transgender athletes and testosterone levels and so on. And that's really, really interesting. So, and Isabel Best on her new book as well. All in the latest Cycling Podcast Feminar. So, chaps, I mentioned that I met Geraint Thomas last week. Slightly awkward, because if you listened to our Tour de France coverage, you will have heard me dismissing his chances of winning the Tour de France. In fact, shall we hear what I said at the time? This is what I said. I think it's completely fanciful to think that Geraint Thomas is a potential Tour de France winner. I just don't see it happening. So you don't ever think that these things will... Well, you don't often think that these things will get back to the rider. But on this occasion, it appears to have done.
Well, he's been listening to the podcast, clearly, and he's taken exception with your ace punditry, Rich. Just reinforces my point about the folly of of any kind of prediction and speculation.
Well, I did enjoy Daniel writing off Michael Valgren's chances of winning Paris-Roubaix there, because of course he famously
he famously
wrote off Peter Sagan. And I was, as you said that, I was thinking I could see Valgren doing all right at Paris-Roubaix.
He usually rides it, does he?
Well, but he can ride the cobbles certainly.
Yeah, I mean, he usually rides a few cobble classics, but the hillier ones, and then does the Ardennes, skips Paris-Roubaix.
He'll be a domestique for Andrea Taffy next year.
Possibly.
But, guys, it was, well, Geraint Thomas obviously doing a bit of a promotional tour for his new book, The Tour According to G, which is the story of his victory at the Tour de France. I actually found it a pretty interesting book. One or two of the things that happened in the tour have made it into the press, the minor kind of hiccups in Team Sky about air conditioning units and whether they would wait for him in the team time trial and so on. But there's contributions too from Tim Kerrison, the coach at Team Sky, and also from Geraint Thomas's wife, Sarah. And they were quite interesting, especially Tim Kerrison, on the sort of work they were doing with Geraint Thomas during the Giro in particular, and how, you know, they knew, and they have known for a long time, that he is the only rider on Team Sky really capable of taking on the same volume, the same workload as Chris Froome. And this has always interested me, because I think at Team Sky we see from time to time a rider put in a brilliant performance, a Wout Poels or somebody like that, Sergio Henao, Richie Porte in the past. And a lot of people say, well, if that guy was the last man rather than the fifth or sixth man, perhaps he could be in Chris Froome's position. And when you speak to people at the team, they will often say, well, it's not quite as simple as that. You know, we know actually what they're capable of, and there's a reason why the hierarchy is what it is. But what was interesting is just that physiologically, in the team, there didn't seem to be much between Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome.
I think we've suspected that for a while based on the performances, even though, as you say, Rich, there have also been riders in the past whose performances on the surface have seemed to be similar to Chris Froome's, but that's not been reflected in the way that Team Sky think about them, talk about them. The big question mark with Thomas was always his ability to negotiate a Grand Tour to get through the 3 weeks, and he's simply never been able to do that without falling ill or crashing. So that was my big doubt. I think it was probably your biggest doubt as well. Physically, I mean, it was a Tour de France in which he didn't seem to be tested that much, in the sense that he wasn't attacked that much. But then, you know, that was down to Sky's strength. It was down to the fact that he didn't really show any weakness, did he? There was never any blood in the water with Geraint Thomas. You know, I think, well, based on what we saw this year, there's every reason why, in theory, they can go in to the Grand Tours next year. We don't know which one he's going to do, which one Froome's going to concentrate on. And there's every reason why they can be fairly confident that he'll have another good go at it. And my slight reservation is that, to my mind, he fits the profile of one of these sort of intergenerational riders, a kind of Carlos Sastre, Stephen Roche, Bjarne Riis, these sort of outliers that have fallen in between the big dynasties in the Tour de France and won one tour.
Hope he's not listening to this, Daniel.
What puzzled me, Rich, was that, well, you made your sweeping statement after the stage win at La Rosière, didn't you? But then after the victory at Alpe d'Huez, you doubled down. And I that was the moment when I started to think, why not? The way he won that, the way he seized the initiative, it was almost un-Geraint Thomas-like.
There was still a long way to go, though. You say my sweeping statement. I was just saying what I thought would happen. So I stand by it, because I wasn't trying to be provocative, really. I say that in the interview to him, but I was really just saying what I thought would happen. And you know, when you cast your mind back to the Giro and Simon Yates, and we obviously spoke about this a lot at the time, and to urge kind of caution and to point out he'd only effectively won one Tirreno Adriatico, then one and a half, and so on. And it came to pass there that he wasn't able to sustain that level over 3 weeks. And I suspected that the same thing might happen to Geraint Thomas,
yeah,
either his performance or bad luck would intervene.
Is there also an argument that, you know, Sky have been very strong in the Tour for many years, but this Team Sky had something that none of the previous ones had had, which was a rider as strong as Egan Bernal. And I think you could make an argument that Egan Bernal was absolutely fundamental to Geraint Thomas winning the Tour. I mean, there were so many moments when, particularly Lotto and El Jumbo riders, were just sort of testing the waters to see if there was any weakness there. And Bernal just quashed that immediately. And it's often in those moments when a guy is off the front where, you know, a team leader or yellow jersey has to chase and just makes an effort which he maybe doesn't pay for right then, but he pays for later in the stage, and that results in a collapse and the loss of several minutes, and, you know, the kind of thing that's undone Geraint Thomas in the past. And that didn't happen.
The thing was, we were looking at Geraint Thomas's past performance as an indicator of what he might do in the Tour de France, and looking at the crashes and the misfortune and the times when he's faltered at the critical moment in smaller stage races, usually as a result of a crash. Paris-Nice, when he was very well placed and crashed out, for example. You know, he's ridden through at least a couple of Tours with really, you know, bad injuries and had to fight his way through. Crashed out of the Giro when he was a joint team leader with Mikel Landa. So we were looking at all of that evidence to try to predict what would happen in the second half of the Tour after La Rosière. But actually, the clearer indicator from past performance was how the Tour has been raced. From certainly 2012 onwards, the person in the yellow jersey after the first big mountaintop finish has won the Tour. And once you're in the Tour, in the yellow jersey, you're almost in a bubble. With Team Sky, especially so, because of their strength in the mountains, as you say, Daniel. And so it looked to me like the Alpe d'Huez stage was the moment when I thought, I now can't see where he will falter, rather than I now can't see how he will hold it together.
And also, it was possibly apparent by that point that it wasn't the Chris Froome of previous years. He had been slightly diminished by his exertions at the Giro.
Yeah, and obviously after Alpe d'Huez, you know, Vincenzo Nibali was out, so that was one kind of wild card factor reduced. Whether Nibali had been a legitimate, credible threat to the yellow jersey or not, he would still have been a dangerous rider, causing mischief in the Pyrenees, perhaps. So the race really simplified for Thomas and Team Sky after Alpe d'Huez, which is why I thought, when you were still making this case that Geraint Thomas couldn't win the Tour on the Champs-Élysées, I thought you'd lost
easy.
It then, Richard.
Easy. At least Fran Reyes was still thinking Fabio Aru would win the Vuelta deep into the third week.
Fran, on the last evening of the Vuelta, we went for a celebratory beer after the final stage, and he spent most of the 20 minutes we spent together arguing the case for Michał Kwiatkowski, for that Vuelta, having proven beyond any doubt that Michał Kwiatkowski was a future Grand Tour winner, which I thought was similarly incongruous.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by beer52.com. How would you like a free case of craft beer? I'm not asking you, Richard. I'm asking
please.
The listeners. As a listener to the show, you can get a case of beer from beer52.com by going to beer52.com/cycling to get your free case. It's just £2.95 postage to get 8 incredible craft beers, a copy of Ferment magazine, which tells you all about the beers and what you're supposed to be tasting, plus a snack, all delivered with next day shipping. Every month focuses on a new country or theme, and if you sign up now, you will get to discover the beers from their Balkans collection. This features amazing beers from up-and-coming brewers in Croatia, Serbia, Slovenia and Bulgaria. Now, Richard, you are actually a subscriber to Beer 52.
I'm a customer. Yeah, I took advantage of the offer and then I signed up, so I get my monthly box. I don't have the Balkans box yet, but I've been working my way slowly through the Raise the Bar box, and there's some very interesting beers in there. One I particularly enjoyed, the Ceviche beer. Quite light, quite fruity. Daniel, are you paying attention to my tasting notes here?
Yes,
because
I
know during the Giro you were very impressed.
Yeah,
they've
become a lot more elaborate over the last few months.
Tasting notes.
Your tasting notes.
I'm cheating a little bit by checking in the Ferment magazine as well, as it says. But I did really enjoy it. I don't often like kind of fruity beers, but this one was very nice. Lime and coriander were the kind of the tastes that I had. That I, very 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 nice indeed. But quite a lot of light beers in that box, IPAs and so on from America and South America, and yeah, thoroughly enjoy. It's nice to have the variety. You know, you don't quite know what you're going to get when you open the bottle.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. You know, I wouldn't immediately think of the Balkans for their beer. Be really interested to know what you make of them when they arrive in your box.
I'll report back.
Well, if any of our listeners want to take advantage of this offer, just visit beer52.com/cycling. That's beer52.com/cycling. £2.95 postage to get your free trial case. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case, try the beers and see what you think. And if it's not for you, you can pause or cancel at any time.
So let's hear from Geraint Thomas. I met him in London last week. We dealt with the, my, as you call it, sweeping statement, Lionel. My opinion during the tour about his prospects of winning the tour. We dealt with that in this interview. And he was slightly offended, but also hopefully amused. Here he is, Geraint Thomas.
I want to go back actually to a little bit in the book by Tim Kerrison about the training camp in Tenerife. Now, a few of us noticed he'd left the Giro, so he wasn't there when Froome was still in contention. He was obviously there with you guys. And when I read that chapter in the book, you realise what you were doing there, and it was a kind of rehearsal for the tour. I mean, while you were there, was that what it felt like to you, and did you feel that you were kind of laying some quite important foundations there potentially?
Yeah, I think I was just feeling good, and all the training was going really well, and I was hitting the numbers every day and improving all the time. When I compared it to the previous years, and it was just on a real good roll really, and then that was reinforced then with the Dauphiné afterwards, with the way I felt there and the way I was riding there. So but yeah, those camps were really good, and for confidence as well, and morale and everything. So, key part of it all, really.
Can you describe what it is you do there? Because the way Tim Kerrison describes it, you set it up almost like a mountain stage in the tour with a full team around you and riding the mountain pretty much as you'd ride, Alpe d'Huez or something. Can you describe exactly what happens?
Yeah, almost sort of, it's kind of two things, really. You get that sort of race simulation almost, and the way you got to sort of make decisions when you're tired and that's best for the team, but then at the same time it's also that competition almost, like within the team, like if you're like, we do sometimes in November we do sprints and we do it against each other rather than just going and, like, if you went out and did a sprint on your own and then you did it with Lionel, I'm sure you'd go quicker, wouldn't you? So doing it with each other it pushes you on. So that was part of it as well, really. And then those blocks in Tenerife, it was like getting to know each other as well. Like, you can all do individual efforts, but it's like knowing how people, or reading people as well, and your teammates and things. And yeah, like I say, the communication and the, if you're not feeling too good, doing a bit more earlier, and just that sort of right decision making. So it was a few things all rolled into one, as well as just actual the physical training of doing those efforts.
I guess you knew what you were capable of, the team knew what you were capable of. Tim Kerrison says that you were the only rider capable of taking on the kind of workload that Froome typically does. Yet Froome obviously was a six-time Grand Tour winner, and you hadn't done that yet. So going into the tour and finding yourself in the yellow jersey, was there a sense that you and the team knew that you were capable of being there and winning it, and it was a case of showing the rest of the world what you already knew?
Yeah, I think so, because as you say, like, I've, in training camps and things, I've always been able to sort of do that workload and never sort of, always kind of wanted to do more and sort of being held back. And I was confident that, yeah, I'd be able to do the whole 3 weeks, because it was the first time I'd really done that. In 2015, I did fall away on stage 19, but I'd done so much beforehand. Like, I wasn't looking after myself. It was just doing what needed to be done. So, and I'd obviously, like, I don't go and read all interviews and stuff, but you hear stuff anyway, and kind of that impression, oh yeah, I'm going to sort of crash or, blow up or whatever.
No one said that, did they?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe some Scottish journalists that don't have a clue, I guess. But but no, it was just, but I kind of, I wouldn't say I was offended or anything. It was just sort of like everyone has their sort of view on it. So, but I was like, oh, okay, I'll, it gave me that sort of extra impetus to to show what I could do, and that belief I had in me. And like, I'm not like a boxer or like Cav, or you know, that comes out and just like comes out swinging and saying everything, you know, and brash and stuff. I just like, off the bike, I'd still just take it. Well, I'm easy going, whatever. Yeah, that's their opinion. And but it does sort of fuel me when I'm training and in a race. And yeah, it was a lot of that, really.
And we get your wife Sarah's point of view as well in the book, and that's quite interesting because it's probably quite revealing in that you do take things on and you are affected by these things perhaps more than you let on, as you say.
Yeah, initially, because we're all just human, aren't we? And if somebody's sort of maybe not giving you a hard time, but sort of just doesn't have that same belief in you that you do in yourself, you kind of question it a bit. And initially, you're like, you're not bad or something. But, like, not you, necessarily. But,
necessarily.
But, yeah, you just sort of, like, initially, it's like, oh, all right, cheers, mate. But then afterwards, you're like, oh, yeah, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, you get into the whole sort of logical way of thinking, and like, well, that's their opinion, that's how they see it, it's fine, whatever, but I'll use this now to prove them wrong. As much, it's not like that's my whole motivation, but it's a little extra on top to sort of really sort of get out there. And you know, when, you know, some people might have said, you know, oh, why is G leaving the classics, he could have won Paris-Roubaix by now or whatever, and which is also like, whatever, yeah, that's one that they might think, but it's my career and what I want to do, and it's what motivates me. And so yeah, it kind of made it even stronger, like, yeah, I need this to succeed, just to, not just for me, but to prove some people wrong.
This is maybe a silly question, but if at the start of your career you'd been offered a deal, you know, that you would have all this bad luck, you know, Rio Olympics, 2017 Giro, 2017 Tour, you could go on in exchange for one, you know, perfect race and victory in that race, would you have taken that deal?
Maybe, yeah, because it's the Tour and it's the biggest thing you can do. It's like I said to Orla the other day, it's like, completed cycling now, haven't I? Like, that's it, tick the box. Like, it's just like, it's just like unreal. So yeah, I don't think, like, Rio as well, it's not kind of in the same category, because that was just a racing mistake by me. It wasn't really bad luck. Whereas obviously 17 was just like unreal, really. But yeah, I think I might have. It's kind of, yeah, it's a hard question, really, but probably. Yeah.
It's interesting that you say, you know, you've completed cycling, and in the book you talk about Froome's mental strength being the key to him repeating, and that winning the Tour once kind of broke Bradley Wiggins. You know, that was it for him. Who are you more like? Are you a Wiggins or a Froome?
I think more Froomey. I'm still motivated now. Like, I can't wait to get back training now, because I feel like I've had too much time off, and I'm motivated to get going again. And I'd love to go through that again, because I really enjoyed it. And I'd only really thought about that because somebody asked me a similar question. And I think, you know, the difference with Brad was he had Froomey, who people were saying could have won it. And, you know, Froomey was like a better climber and things, and then was, had that, you know, the next year was going to be even bigger battle. And Brad probably just didn't want to get into that again and just wanted to win the Tour, take that and just sort of move on. I think that was definitely part of it. So yeah, I'm definitely more the Froome, sort of still really enjoy riding and training, and I'm on that challenge now of going back. And you know, it's still not 100% Giro or Tour, but at the end of the day, if you'd asked me at the start of the year or career, would you take two Tours or a Giro and a Tour, you'd probably say two Tours. But yeah, we'll see.
Have you looked at the courses yet for both races and thought about that? And I guess Egan Bernal comes into the mix as well, because, you know, he looks like he'll be contending sooner rather than later for something.
Yeah, for sure. Egan, like, was just incredible the year he had, and for sure he's going to be right up there sooner rather than later. But yeah, I looked at the Giro route briefly, and that's exciting. That makes me want to go there for sure. And then I obviously was at the Tour presentation, but that's the only bit I've seen of the Tour so far. And then it's like a big quick thing in it, so you don't really see it properly. But obviously grand tours are hard, which whatever sort of mountains they go over and things, but you know, obviously there's a lot of altitude in the tour, and I tend to feel okay at altitude, so that doesn't worry me. So yeah, it's just something I'm gonna have to do the next couple of weeks really, and see what, because I don't want to try and do both. I think you can do both well. After seeing Dumoulin and Kruijswijk, I thought it's only Froome that can do it, but seeing those guys, you know, Dumoulin obviously second in both, and then Kruijswijk like top five in Tour and the Vuelta, so it's made me think, oh, you can perform in two, but whether to actually win two is slightly different.
Much is made of the fact you are easygoing, and in the book, you know, when there are things that happen with the air conditioning unit and the you know, the team, very, you know, Froome remaining very much the most protected rider, you given the free roll. Will you be as easygoing next year? You know, will it change you in a sense, make you slightly more demanding?
Maybe. Certainly with like the whole team time trial thing, it would do. You know, I'd want them to wait for me. But when it comes to like everything else, like the aircon thing, and like I thought it was just a funny sort of story to tell to just show the mentality of the team, how it was really. And that still wouldn't bother me, to be honest. Like, I'm still easygoing and things and whatever. Like, but yeah, I'll certainly have a lot more. You know, I've done it now. You know, I've shown that I can race over those 3 weeks. And I think that was the whole thing this year, was the whole uncertainty. You know, I think the team certainly believed in me. I didn't think they didn't believe in me, but you know, when you've got Froome there who's 1-6, it's, you know, you'd be, you know, if you're a betting man, you know, a lot of people would put more money on Froome than me, so you can kind of get that.
I always thought you'd do it.
listen to it, you know.
No.
It was funny because after the tour, obviously it went really well for me, so I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to a few podcasts, see what people were saying. And what was that word? Fanciful. Yeah. Appreciate that. Yeah,
I think it was deliberately provocative. You know, I was trying to get a reaction from people, not necessarily you, but I was going to ask, just after you won the tour, how aware, you were obviously out of contract at the end of the year, how aware were you of interest from other teams, and how far did those conversations, if they even start, how far did they go?
Yeah, they were serious. There was a serious offer from the new CCC team, and I thought about that, you know, properly. It didn't take it lightly at all, and the reason I ended up staying was I saw it as a new team. Okay, it's two teams joining, but it's still new, and for me it seemed slightly a bit of a risk. You know, a new team always takes a year to sort of really sort of iron out any cracks and things, and with Sky I know exactly how it works. I know how to get in the very best shape, and if I want to win a Grand Tour, I need to be in my very best shape. I can't be 95% and, you know, have a bit of an issue with something in the background. So, and I'm comfortable here. I know how everything works. You know, the team know me, and it just seemed, especially now when I'm at the end of my career, which is quite scary to think of. But, you know, I think I've got 3 more good years in me for like Grand Tour riding. So I don't want to like throw them away, and just wanted to make the most of them. And, you know, obviously the only thing was that the Froome's still here for at least 2 years, and you're going to have that slight sort of, if we end up doing the tour, you know, you're going to have that who's 100% behind who, and obviously you're going to have to answer all the questions, which is probably going to be the most annoying thing of it all. So,
Who do you see, you know, Sky have been dominant for a few years now, but who do you see as a rider or a team that you see as a particular threat over the next year or so?
I think there's a lot of good riders for sure that are threats, you know, from, well, everyone, even the, you know, look how talented Landa and Quintana are, then obviously Dumoulin and Roglic and Bardet, and individually I think, you know, we're all at a very similar level, but I think the main difference with us is that how strong our team is, and, you know, everyone bangs on about the money and this and that, but obviously it's got a part to play, but I think you still got to use it the right way, and that everyone in our team has improved. And everyone wants to be a part of that tour team. It's kind of got that aura about it now. Like, even guys in other teams, they might not admit it vocally, but I'm sure they'd love to be a part of that Sky team and in the tour. and that competition for places, everyone's pushing on for to get their spot in that team, and that's the key sort of thing that makes us so strong, I think. And but obviously Jumbo, a lot of Jumbo were super strong at the end of the tour, and there's a lot of good teams, but I think we just have that slight advantage that it is, it's sort of that winning mentality and that sort of drive, everyone wants to be in there, and it's our only goal. It's, you know, Jumbo still had Groenewegen going for sprints, and you know, the whole year is really about the tour with Sky, and that makes a big difference when it comes to elite sort of sport.
So you say you've got 3 more years challenging for Grand Tours. Are you leaving space there to, you know, everyone always talks about the couple of classics, Paris-Roubaix in particular, but Tour Flanders as well. Is there still in your head, even, you know, Tokyo in 2020, who knows, but is there still an ambition on your part to try and win one of those races as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think I can do that even later. You know, I think into my the last year of this contract, maybe when I'm turning 35 that year or even 2 years after that, I think, you know, you look at Valverde and, okay, he might be a freak, and but he's 38 and just won the world. So I think you can, as long as you're committed and you can do all the training and still, you know, all the diet and all the hard yards, and if you can still do all that, I think you can keep going for a long time. You know, Chris Hoy, Sir Chris Hoy, won, you know, a gold medal when he was, what, 36, and everyone says you lose your speed when you get older. So I think if you have that commitment and that drive, you can still perform at a really high level. So yeah, I want to go back to the classics, but the next sort of 3 years is concentrated on Grand Tours.
Winning the Tour won't affect your commitment, you don't think?
What do you mean? Like,
I mean, having done it, that won't take away some of the drive.
It'll be different for sure, because it's always that first time. You're always so much more. Well, I don't know yet, but I'd imagine it's that driving for something you haven't achieved. But it'll still be there because you want that again, and that fear of sort of being worse than this year, and also I'm sure people have said like, oh, but maybe he's a one-hit wonder or something. So that's that. Have you said that?
Not yet.
But no, yeah. So I'll still be motivated. I still love riding my bike, and just that sadistic sort of side of me of just hurting myself. And it's still a tour. I'm still a massive fan of the sport, and it's still a kid inside, really. And I'll still want to go there in the best shape I can.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25 at the checkout. We're still accepting questions as well for the Science of Sport experts. Please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or if you prefer, you can leave a voice memo at the number +447971338205. That's a WhatsApp voice memo, I should have specified, at +447971338205. Don't call the number, but do leave a voice memo if you prefer to leave a question for the Science of Sport experts that way. This week's question will be answered by Ben Samuels, and it comes from Sam Chin. Hi guys, just a quick question for the guys at Science and Sport. I know that cycling and coffee go hand in hand, and that many of your products contain caffeine bars and gels with caffeine boost, etc. However, for medical reasons, I no longer have caffeine in my diet. Could you recommend any suitable caffeine-free replacements to have while cycling? Thanks, Sam.
While caffeine is a popular choice for endurance athletes, and in particular cyclists, effective fueling strategies can be developed completely caffeine-free. If we keep in mind that caffeine mainly acts centrally, and the benefits are in reducing the perception of effort and feelings of fatigue, then those would be the areas to focus on. This will place increased demand on carbohydrate fueling during performance, as reduced carbohydrate availability can also lead to tiredness and fatigue out on rides. For those long endurance rides, we should be looking to fuel with 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour on the bike, and that really starts from the first hour. The practicalities of achieving that will be a combination of isotonic energy gels, energy bars, bananas, and other whole foods, with carbohydrate electrolyte drinks in the bottle to meet your needs.
So that was me speaking to Geraint Thomas. Such a glamorous life. I'm now in the back of a cab with Orla Shinawy.
Sounds decidedly dodgy, which it's not.
It's not. Orla, you had warmed up Geraint Thomas by interviewing him at greater length the day before, hadn't you? The day before I met him.
Yes, I did. He gave me a nice extended interview for... You've allowed me to plug it, so I will. Upcoming season of my new podcast, When Orla Met. Geraint's going to be one of the first interviews. And I was actually really surprised by him because I'd say, you know, we've seen him do the rounds on so many different forms of media, telling various stories from the tour to various different kinds of audiences. And I just thought he might be a bit exhausted by the time I got to him because it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He'd done a round during that day. He'd been on Radio 1 the day before. And I was just a bit worried as to how generous he'd be with his stories and his thoughts. And he was brilliant. It was really good fun, actually, reliving the tour through his eyes because he's someone we've known for such a long time, but always in a support role. And there's only so much of a support role story that you ever get, and there's only so much that you that makes its way through all the clamour of all the other stories, because it's always the winner's story that you hear most, and that's the one that's dominant. And it was really lovely to hear Geraint's version of the Tour de France as the winner. You know, we'd both read the book before chatting to him, and it just gave me a different kind of an insight, because we're obviously watching it from the outside and talking about a rider that we think we know so well. And to see and read and feel his insight into the race, just I don't know, it just felt so completely different. And I also, from my chat to him, what I've always been intrigued with Geraint Thomas about, and I think a lot of us who followed him for a while are the same, I just have never really understood how he can win races, or if he could win races, because we talk about this need for a bad boy element to someone, or just to be a bit mean or be a bit nasty or have a darker side to them, which we've never really seen in Geraint Thomas before.
Ruthless, a ruthless streak.
Yeah, but with a negative connotation to it, because ruthless doesn't have to be, well, I guess it does have to be negative to a certain extent because it has to be exclusionary. But I asked him about that, and I got a real sense of what it is that makes him the champion or has made him a champion. And it's this sort of extreme element to his personality, which, you know, he's maybe hinted at before, or maybe we've seen flickers of before, in terms of, you know, he lives life to the full in the off season. We've always heard stories about him putting in an extra hour on the bike when he's told to train for 4 hours, for example. He'll go out for 5 hours. But I got a real sense of the reality of that from chatting to him, and just how he indulges those extremes of his personality, which I find absolutely fascinating, and it made a lot of sense to me. I felt like, right, it's clicked now. Now I understand how you won the Tour de France. So it was a brilliant chat with him.
I think we talked about this a bit last night in our show at the Clapham Grand, which we've mentioned a few times, but that, you know, we had Larry Warbass on stage. Larry lives quite close to Geraint Thomas and sometimes trains with him, and so has quite a good insight into who he is and what he does, I suppose. And he took issue a little bit with this notion that you have to be a bad guy. I mean, Francois always makes this point, you have to be a bad guy to win a Grand Tour. And Larry pointed out, as far as his experience tells him, Tom Dumoulin is a nice guy as well. But what's interesting in Geraint Thomas's book is what comes across is Chris Froome does have that streak. Now, Chris Froome's polite and all the rest of it, but he definitely is extremely driven. And, you know, we saw at the tour, as Thomas reports in his book, that despite the positions being what they were, with Geraint further up the pecking order, Froome was still perfectly prepared to ride his own race and attack and try and seize it back, you know. That was sort of respecting the hierarchy, the pecking order that Team Sky had established. But yeah, I mean, look, we made a joke in there about me writing him off and saying it was fanciful that he could win the tour, and he took that in pretty well. But he was a bit annoyed. I mean, he was a bit annoyed, no question. And I don't really blame him for that, because to hear himself be written off like that can't have been all that nice, and so he was a bit annoyed. But I think, you know, able to get over it as well. But, you know, just there is an ego there, obviously, and there is, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the extreme lifestyle that's required. And what was interesting as well for me reading the book was the, you know, the, especially there's a chapter by Tim Kerrison where he talks about the team knowing that Geraint Thomas's physical capability is very similar to Froome's. He is the only other rider on the team capable of doing the same kind of efforts and training. And we often see flashes of brilliance from people like Wout Poels or Sergio Henao or, you know, Richie Porte in the past. And you think, well, this guy, you know, if he's given a chance, he could step up, he could win the Tour. And I remember speaking to coaches at Sky about this, and they just dismiss this idea that, you know, that anybody with a certain ability could step into the leader's shoes and do what Froome has done so consistently. They know from the training sessions, you know, day in, day out, throughout the year, they know exactly what each of them is capable of.
And the other thing about Geraint Thomas, which again you lose until somebody becomes a winner, because you only really get to explore this side of their personality once they have won and they're doing this whole round of media and they're maybe a bit more willing to open themselves up a little bit. But, you know, when you say about Froome attacking Geraint Thomas and, you know, the hierarchy being very much that established pecking order of Froome is at the top and Geraint Thomas, you know, to a certain extent, was a protected rider, but, you know, he was left to his own devices. But what I find really fascinating from chatting to him, in the book he talks about the respect that he has for Froome, but actually what he's learned to do over the years, and partly because of his work with Dr. Steve Peters, who I've also actually interviewed for.
Alright, that's enough plugging
now.
But it
sort of ties in with it, because I find this really fascinating, because we can be misled very easily by Geraint's sort of outward placid nature, but that's also a learned behaviour, and it's also a winning behaviour, because he's managed
to... Oh my God, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid here, eh?
No, listen, he has managed to detach the emotion from all of it, and that's the only way he was able to, I think, deal with Froome's attacks, because how can you, any normal person, put themselves in that scenario where they're winning the Tour de France and their teammate is telling them to their face on one occasion, and not so much their face on the other occasion, that they're going to attack them as the yellow jersey rider, but see that in a conceptual way by being able to detach from it and say, well, he obviously wants to win. He's not attacking me personally. He's attacking the yellow jersey. Well, you're wearing the yellow jersey, so obviously it's personal. But he was able to take all the emotion out of that, go through the process, go through the logic of it. And that's a mental training. It is. It's not about, you know, whether it's drinking the Kool-Aid or not. He's done that and he's managed to do it with such success. And if he'd allowed emotion to come into it, he wouldn't have won.
Seb Piquet and Francois Thomazeau in the same building together. What a moment. What a moment. Francois, thank you for coming over to London. Have you had a nice time?
Great time. Every time I come to London, it's too short, much too brief. And I you know, today I decided every time I come to London, thanks to the Cycling Podcast, you know, on the Cycling Podcast expense, I have to say it, I take the opportunity to visit a nice, very, you know, nice museum, a nice place. I wanted to go to Sir John Soames Museum today. It's closed on Tuesdays, unfortunately. So I had to, you know, I had to actually had a quick walk in Hyde Park and have a quick siesta. So, yeah, next time, you know, I'll make sure I stay a little bit longer in London. But it's always a pleasure to be here.
Seb, you're more familiar with London. We're looking ahead. A couple of weeks ago, we looked ahead to the Tour de France next year. What can we look forward to on the Tour next year? What are your highlights?
I think it's going to be really interesting to... this is going to sound very corporate. To see how the riders cope with altitude, that's the main thing. It's going to be a very high Tour de France next year, so that's going to be pretty fun. It's also
how's the guy in the car going to cope with altitude?
Should be all right, because I also, you know, as you know, I also work on the Dakar Rally, and we're going to Peru this year. We were in Bolivia, so we were above 3,000 meters, so it should be all right.
I heard champagne bubbles. You know, the champagne has less bubbles in altitude than it does in the plane, so it'll be a problem in your car.
Yes, but we have officially stopped champagne a few years ago since Jean-François Bichot left. So we've completely stopped champagne.
Francois, what do you make of the tour? What can we most look forward to next year?
Well, we discussed it a little bit before when the route was announced. I'm quite excited about the Massif Central stages. Maybe because I'm in the same generation, same school, same everything as Christian Prudhomme. I probably share his views on the way a tour course should be designed. I remember the 1989 Tour de France. Well, of course, you know, everybody remembers the fight between Laurent Fignon and Greg LeMond. Lots of the very exciting action took place around Saint-Étienne in these hills, which are actually very mountainous. I think all these stages around Saint-Étienne, Brioude, and you know, where Romain Bardet will be at home, could be actually maybe the most exciting moments of the tour next year.
I think what I'm eventually excited about is what is going to happen in the months or the weeks to come concerning cycling and the Tour de France. Will there be radios? Will there be power meters? How many riders will be in teams? I think that could also make a great big difference, maybe more than the course itself.
And what do you doyens of cycling? How do you spend the off season?
Well, it's another season that starts for me because I work on other events, motorsports events, the Dakar. And then start slowly focusing and keeping an eye on what goes on in the different teams, the transfers, the new riders here and there, the new DSs and here and there. That will slowly take us to the first races of the year. For me, it'll be the Tour of Oman.
What I realized, Seb, last year when we had Matt White over was that you in the car with Race Radio, with Chief Commissar, you get to know the DSs very well as well, don't you?
Yeah. I certainly do. I mean, I've had the opportunity to have a lot of chats with Philippe Mauduit, Matt White, Nicolas Portal from Sky, and it's always good to have a chat with them to ask them if they're happy with what I do and with the way the races are organised, because maybe we can improve and make things better for them as well and for cycling in general.
Francois, how do you spend the off season?
There's never enough season for a freelancer, as you know. No, actually, well, it's strange. I never think of the season in terms of there is a season and an off season. I'm always a kind of amateur, you know. So I always take it lightly. What do I do when there's no cycling around? I cook different bouillabaisse every day, looking for the perfect recipe. I think that's about it. No, I've got lots of books to write. I've got lots of stuff to do. Bouillabaisse being one of them.
So among the luminaries who've joined us in London for our show at the Clapham Grand, I mean, chief among them, Ciro Scogna Emilio. Ciro, wonderful to have you with us in London. What does the off-season hold for you?
Well, Richard, first of all, the fact that I'm in London explains really well how big is my love for the podcast and for our listeners, because I could have been on a beach, not here, but instead I'm here, and this is only for the love that I have for all our marvelous audience. And concerning my off-season, well, Richard, it's easy, because during the cycling season I don't think a lot about cycling. During the off season, even less. Cycling is not really 100% of my life. How can I explain you? So no cycling, not even thinking about cycling, never. I spend the majority of my days, I try not to go to the office. I try to remain at home, going when I can to the beach, because I came back to my family often in Naples. But the special thing is for me to reach, to try to spend a day and more days doing absolutely nothing, dear Richard. My point.
How do you keep a job, Ciro?
I don't know. In my opinion, it has been a question maybe of destiny, of luck. But if I can choose, a life with a job and a life without a job, you can easily understand, and also our listeners can easily understand which life I choose without a job.
Do you have much contact with the shark of Messina over the winter?
Yes, and I can say to our listener that I had 3 days ago the opportunity to meet him, because in one of my few days of work of this winter, of this last part of the year, I met him during a special event in Piemonte, not far from Milan. So I spoke to him. Also, he had holidays on a beach in Zanzibar, and now he's almost ready to start with the new season. In December, he will do a training camp with his Bahrain Merida team in Croatia, and he will decide his plans, which Grand Tours will be at the start of next season.
What about the peacock? Are we going to see the peacock again next year?
I mean, with the peacock of Sandrigo, I spoke a few days ago, but for the moment, I can't say neither to other listeners about what we have talked about, because there will be a surprise about the peacock of Sandrigo, I hope soon on Gazzetta.
News coming soon.
I don't know how soon, but I hope before the end of this year there will be important news about him and I can't anticipate anything to our listeners. Sorry, but I can't.
Oh, so teasing, so tantalizing, Gio.
Yeah, I mean, it's something certainly linked to the life of the peacock, cycling life and not only. So stay tuned as usual.
Wow, Ciro, well, enjoy your off-season and we'll see you back on the road in 2019.
And I hope so, thanks to all our old marvelous audience. And remember, dear listeners, without a job, in my opinion, is always better than with a job.
So it's been a mixed bag this week's episode. We've heard from Geraint Thomas, from Orla Shinui, Ciro Scognamiglio, Francois Thomas, Seb Piquet, and Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib and me, Richard Moore. And hopefully you've enjoyed hearing some of the familiar voices of the podcast in this episode.
Oh, it's been like the whole cycling podcast family. We're like the Waltons now, aren't we?
The Spice Girls reunion.
But no posh. Oh,
that shows our cultural references, doesn't it? I reference the Waltons, which hasn't been on television for 30 years, and Daniel references the...
Oh, bringing it right up to date with the Spice Girls.
The band of his teenage years.
Excellent. Well, listen, we should wrap things up for this week. We've got some different episodes coming up through the off season, haven't we, Lionel? Maybe as early as next week, we'll have something a little bit different. Mm. But before that, we've got the Explore series to look forward to. Can't wait to listen to episode one.
You can listen to it now, Rich.
I'm going to do that on the way home. Yeah, okay. Something to look forward to.
Good.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel. Safe travels.
Thank you, chaps.